IFSA is an organization of fire service personnel dedicated to upgrading firefighting techniques and safety through training. Between their manuals, ebooks, apps, curriculum, exam prep, Resource One, and more, firefighter training has never been more customizable than with IFSA FPP products. Visit them at ifsta.org for more information. Did you know the risk of cancer does not stop at the scene of a fire? Firefighters are constantly exposed to diesel exhaust fumes and other airborne toxins that get trapped inside the station. Protect yourself with MagnaGrip through the combination of MagnaGrip exhaust removal systems and AirHawk air purification systems. Learn more at MagnaGrip.com.
Welcome to Fire Service Court Radio. My name is Brad Pinsky, and I'm your host for this episode of Fire Service Court Radio. And with me are the esteemed attorneys of the Fire Service Court Radio. I've got John Murphy and Chip Comstock. Missing today for the moment is Kurt Barone. And today we've got a very hot issue for all fire departments, including volunteer, paid on call, and paid. And we're going to talk about the Fair Labor Standards Act and what is too much pay to convert a person who is a volunteer to the status of employee. And let me just start by saying, and John and Chip will go into the facts, but let me just start by saying that if you are giving any type of benefits to your volunteers, this could be include length of service award programs, and you also pay them a certain amount of money for standbys, drills, trainings, gift cards, anything like that, you are at risk of converting your volunteers to career firefighters. And if you lose that fight and the Department of Labor or a court, in the case of what we're going to talk about shortly, deems them to be employees, you are going to pay millions of dollars. So you do not want to miss this discussion. Okay, Chip and John, take it away.
So, hey, Chip, let me start here. Being that this is the Washington case, to give a little background, and then I think we can have you just fill in on the details here. But the state of Washington has pretty much always compensated volunteer firefighters in some form or fashion. Now, I know that there are some states, and maybe Brad can illuminate this a little bit, but some states are prevented from giving any sort of compensation in a monetary form to volunteer firefighters. And Washington State is pretty much, and I've been in the service here since 1970, and I'm not going to tell you the exact date, but it's been a while, where our volunteer firefighters either received an hourly compensation for hours served and or some other form of compensation. And the volunteers here are part of a pension system for volunteer firefighters that hours accrue, and at the end of their term of service, which could be 20 years probably, they receive a small pension from the pension fund here in Washington State. The confusion that we had was, are these volunteers actual employees of an organization? And then the other is, if the volunteer was classified as a resident. And many departments out here have what's called resident programs. So these are essentially volunteers that will stay in the station after hours, like from the hours of 6 to 6 so they're pulling a 12-hour shift, and then work a regular job in the community. Are they, do they remain volunteers in the organization? And although their status has changed to a resident, where the fire department or the fire district provides living space and accommodations for individuals staying at the fire station, essentially to supplement a career service and maybe combination departments, or in totally volunteer departments where there may be the necessity for rapid response in the evening time, where people who, you know, maybe work outside the community and then they live, come back to the community, and they're their evening position, I guess, would be as a resident firefighter. When I worked at Lacey Fire Department down in Thurston County in the 70s, one of the local colleges supplied firefighters to our department, and those guys were residents. They worked a two-shift system. They responded on calls. They were given some stipend and a nominal amount of money to provide that service. But I think the biggest benefit was that they had a place to stay. They didn't have to stay in campus dorms. They didn't have to get any community housing. They basically used the fire station as their domicile, as their place to live. One of the questions that circulated around is, now, is this taxable income? Being that the fire department was providing this sort of resource, which has an actual monetary value, can it be a taxable sort of an event? And I think that the Washington State Legislature years ago and through the IRS and the feds essentially determined that the amount of money that they would charge for residents living in the fire station was, again, a nominal sort of amount of money, and it wasn't really considered taxable income. As we kind of fast forward here to this particular case, which I think is the one that we're going to talk about tonight, it talks about those issues being, are they volunteers? And Chip's going to say that, are, you know, these guys, they claim to work 3,000 hours per year. And as those of you who work a full-time job, you know, 2080, I think, is the full-time equivalent for some person who actually has a job and works every day, you know, 40 hours a week, 52 weeks a year. Those numbers would classify any ordinary individual as a laborer. And so if these guys are claiming that they're working 3,000 hours, which is in excess of a full-time job, interestingly enough, I think it created this sort of conundrum for the department as to how they were going to, how are they, first of all, they're going to classify, you know, these volunteers, and what's the compensation rate for individuals to either stand by in the fire station, be classified as volunteers or as resident firefighters in a particular program. Chip. Did Chip fall asleep?
Chip, do we have you?
You do now. I didn't realize that my microphone was on mute, so I apologize for that. What I was going to say is that I don't think that this issue is limited simply to Washington State. As you said, it happens elsewhere. What I see many places is that with respect to volunteers, we have the no compensation situation. I mean, there's no money. But as Brad said earlier, there may be some other form of remuneration other than cash that gets paid, you know, in some other form of benefit. Then we have, in terms of a cash, we have a paid-on-call system, which is what my department currently is, where it's the fee is not tied to productivity. It's or an hour or a specific hour. It's, you know, you're going to get paid. One call is, I'm just making up numbers, $15, and you come to a training session, and you get $20. And it doesn't matter how long those go. It's just to offset some of the ideas. It's going to offset the expenses that you might have in terms of you know, maybe laundry, clothing, you know, gas in your car, so wear and tear, et cetera. And then we have, you know, the straight hourly rate, whether it's a career or a part-time paid position, it's hourly. And where some of the departments in Ohio, what I see happening is that they're at a paid-on-call situation, but they want to convert because they're having trouble covering the daytime calls. So during that conversion, they'll say, well, we want you to be here for 8 hours. But they want to kind of stay in the traditional flat fee arrangement. So rather than saying we're paying you hourly, we're going to give you X dollars per time you're here. So, you know, if you're here for 8 hours, we're going to give you $80. And so it starts having this sort of productivity time relationship, but you'll never hear anybody say you're getting paid hourly. You're just getting this flat fee. And so everybody's getting the either flat fee per call or flat fee per training or flat fee per work detail, but we're also doing a flat fee per shift. And when somebody goes off that hourly shift, they're still back to the flat fee arrangement. So, you know, in this case that we're talking about, which again happened in Washington State, there were two employees. And one of the critical thing that happened here in Washington State is they were fired. Now, everybody in your department might love you as the chief or the administrator, and you love each other, and nobody on your department will ever think about suing you over how they're compensated until you fire them. And so, you know, if you don't think there's a chance that you're going to get sued, you have to make the assumption that there's never going to be a termination, or that, again, that it's a spouse or somebody else in the family due to an unusual circumstance that always makes that claim. So in this case, the organization, the fire department, which is actually in Washington, it's a county fire protection district, employed a number of folks, and they categorized everybody who they employed as volunteers. And as John suggested, they were paid $50 per 12-hour shift and $100 per 24-hour shift. And they also received extra money if they worked at a racetrack. They worked at an hourly rate there, and they were paid additional money per hour on an on-call service basis. And so things go along fine for a couple of years with these two employees until they're terminated in 2020. And they file a claim, and they say that, well, you said we were volunteers, we're really employees. And they claim that the district violated the Fair Labor Standards Act's minimum wage and overtime provisions because they weren't paying both the state and federal minimum wage, and they were not paid overtime when they would have worked over the threshold number of hours, which is 40 hours for a straight EMS worker per week, or under federal law for firefighters can be generally 53 hours per week, 106 per 2 weeks, and 212 hours for 4 weeks. So anyways, they made these various claims. Again, they also made claims for state law claims for wrongful discharge and for unjust enrichment, and they sought not only the compensatory damages, saying what they were owed should have been paid, they were paid improperly, but they also made a claim for punitive damages. And so the court had to do an analysis, and it, as it relates to the merits why we're here, they first had to look at are they generally employees or volunteers? The court went through and addressed some of those issues, and what the volunteer exemption was. And one of the things that the courts, I'll just mention off the top, and Brad could talk about the standards a little bit more, but one of the things in terms of volunteer, whether the employees, they said, we don't care. The court said, we don't care how the employer classifies them. It doesn't matter what label you use. It doesn't matter what job description you might put in. The courts, in determining whether somebody's a volunteer or an employee, is going to look at the realities of the situation. They're going to look and see what actually happens here, you know, as how are they actually treated, how are they functioned, how are they paid, et cetera. So if there are departments out there say, oh, you know, we're going to call them volunteers and we're going to write this job description, we're just going to, you know, wink and a nod and say this is how we're going to get around that, it won't work. So the courts are going to look at, you know, what actually happens and has a number of tests to determine whether somebody is a volunteer and should be treated as such, or whether somebody's an employee who's entitled to overtime compensation under EFLSA. Brad, you're up.
Sure. So here there's a couple notable points what happened. So first of all, they were volunteering 3,000 hours a year, I believe. And the court, who, by the way, kind of disagrees with the Federal Department of Labor's stance on this, which is very interesting, but the court says, listen, no person volunteers 3,000 hours. Now, I think that shows extreme ignorance to what some of the volunteer firefighters do. We absolutely do spend that much time, but court said, you know, that's a little much. And the other thing the court says, before I get to their main point, is that these individuals did not sign a statement admitting that they're volunteers. Now, I don't know why this matters one way or the other, because they would have just said they were coerced into signing it. But the biggest factor is that these two individuals said they rely on this money for their main income and as a major part of their income. It is not just passive income. And that meant a lot because they spent enough time to generate a significant amount of money. So what happens is a court under the federal regulations looks to see whether what they got is a nominal fee. And a nominal fee is generally defined as 20% of what somebody who does the job for a living would earn. And the problem is, you know, they look at these standbys and said, man, they're making a good amount of money. It's not like they're making $2 or $3 an hour. These guys are making, in some cases, you know, twice minimum wage, and they're making real money, right? But the test, again, that came out, I don't know, maybe a decade ago or so, when they defined what de minimis value is 20% of what somebody would be being paid. I disagree with some of this. I think, I don't have the facts in front of me. I think they're being paid like $14 or $15 an hour for a standby. And they're like, you know, those are real wages. Except the problem is standbys would have been performed, if it was a career firefighter, on overtime, which would have cost a lot more than $14 or $15 an hour, right? That could have been $60 or $70 or $80. So I kind of disagree with the court on this, but let me jump to the oh crud moment where probably the, you know, the employer now needs to change their diapers once they got this decision. The penalty for violating Fair Labor Standards Act is that you not only have to pay the employee, and not just these two employees, right? You may have to go back and pay all your employees for the last 3 years, although they could have gone back six. I think they went back for three, but they could have gone back for six. And you have to pay them not just for the fair labor wages that they were paid for their call time, but also for drill time, meeting time, training time, fundraising time, any time. And the reason is you cannot be both a volunteer and an employee in the same organization in the same capacity. So if a volunteer, quote-unquote volunteer firefighter, did trainings and drills and standbys and meetings and fundraising, they have to be paid for all of that time. And as Chip correctly said, once they cross a certain number of hours, which is probably going to be 53 because they have interior firefighting as part of their duties, so they get a benefit under federal law. Once you cross 53 hours, then you're paying time and a half. But the fun ain't over there because we have a disincentive. The law has a disincentive to just violating it. You don't just go and get ordered to be paid back what you should have paid. You can be ordered to pay three or six times that amount. The federal government and state governments, when they come in, are going to come in and nail you for this. But the fun doesn't end there, because since you failed to pay the proper employee wages, there may be a ton of other laws where the dominoes keep falling. Now, this is going a little bit beyond the case, but this is why you've got three knowledgeable attorneys here. Also happens is the IRS can get involved and nail the employer for failing to provide or pay the employer taxes on the amounts that are going to be owed because you paid too late. The disability insurance can get involved, saying you should have insured them for all their activities. Health insurance, if there's a health insurance mandate in your state and you weren't providing that benefit because you have a full-time employee, time off, paid time off, sick leave, family and medical leave. All of these things come in now because you had paid employees and you violated this. And let me end with this. And this is only going to be a, you know, 30-minute show. We got 10 minutes to go. But let me end at least this diatribe with this. there are attorneys who do nothing but sue under Fair Labor Standards Act violations. I know because every so often I get a call and I'm asked to, hey, join our team. You'll make a lot of money. And that's just not how, you know, John, Chip, Kurt, and I roll. We defend the fire departments. We don't prosecute them, sue them. But they will look for these types of cases, and they try to find you. And they will profit it better because once you're done paying the employees, now you have to pay the attorneys for their time. They get paid. I am telling you, this is so expensive that if you are in any way compensating your employees in excess of the specific amount allowed by your state laws, you darn well better get a good lawyer to review your program and get a written opinion letter from them that says what you're doing will not convert these volunteers to employees because you will bankrupt this city. That's kind of my, you know, soapbox stance. Back to you guys.
Well, I was going to say, I was waiting, as you were adding up the penalties, I was thinking, well, not only do you get to pay for your own legal fees, you get to pay for the employee's legal fees. And to the extent those employees' attorneys are specialists, they aren't going to come cheap. If you're in federal court, which often you're going to be, where there's a lot of work that has to be done, I mean, your fees, depending on how much this matter is contested, could very well tens of thousands of dollars, if not, you know, $100,000. I mean, as Brad said, this will rack up the cost very quickly. Brad mentioned the 20%, you know, looking at around, and one of the things the court does, it's, you know, sort of the economic realities test in determining how much compensation that a volunteer might be making. Because, again, there's a lot of different things that benefits in trying to attract volunteer firefighters you may give them. And insurance isn't the comp, workers' comp, some limited insurance benefits may not be viewed as compensation as such that it's going to equal make that person employee. But if you, again, once you start giving the money and all these things start adding up, they look to your neighboring departments that have career firefighters, and if your compensation is above 20% of what your neighboring departments might be paying, the presumption sort of switches to that you're violating that person's an employee and you're not treating them, the employee, properly, that they should be paying overtime, et cetera, should be paying them on an hourly basis. And if you don't have a neighboring department that's clear, that you're the first one that's really paying folks and there's nobody around you to compare you with, they'll go to the, you know, region or then the state and then nationally if they have to. But they're gonna try to find the most comparable group that they can to look at, you know, does your department pay more than or compensate more than 20% of a career employee?
And that's where I got to tell you, that's why I think the court screwed up. I think the court was wrong here. I don't really believe they met their burden here. And I'm presuming there's going to be an appeal, but I don't really believe that they were exceeding, maybe they exceeded 20% just, but they're really, face of what the case says, it doesn't seem like they were really paid that much more. And, you know, I think the biggest factor here was that they said, well, they relied on this income just like they would a regular job. But that's not the standard. That was, you know, that was a court-made standard. So I personally think the court got it wrong. But regardless, I'm going to repeat it again. If people are paying, like, I mean, cash, you know, gifts and things like that, and you're exceeding the paid-on-call requirements, if you're one of those states, I'm in New York, we don't have paid-on-call, but if you're paying people for responses, you're literally playing with fire. And this is true in any volunteer capacity, not just, you know, not just the fire services, but you guys got to be careful.
again, the issue, and I speak, you know, from experience in Ohio and watching other departments do it, even if you're paid on per call, you'd have to work, you'd have to run a ton of calls to come anywhere close to a 20% mark. But it's, again, once you start paying people shifts like this place did and said, well, we're paying you. And again, it's the difference in a pay per call, it's not tied to productivity. So it doesn't matter how many hours you spend there. If you're there for 5 minutes, you're going to get that $20 or $15 or whatever. If you're there for 2 hours, when you start tying how you're compensating somebody to an hourly rate or an hourly period of time, that's when it starts looking a lot more like it's a productivity-based system, and that's what starts raising the eyebrows.
And clearly the standby here has crossed that line.
Yeah. Well, again, depends. Or, you know, one of the things with standby can be, are you requiring somebody to be standby at a particular location, or is it, you know, like a standby on call? I mean, we pay people, you could, the law suggests that you can have, even require people to be on call so often as long as they're not tied to or so restricted to either a location or, you know, restrict their activities or mobility, et cetera. And there's departments that pay, hey, we're going to pay you $10 or $15 to be available, but you can respond to the station. That usually doesn't get into FLSA violations because, again, it's not you're not viewed as being so restrictive that you're at the mercy of the employer.
Right, and here that wasn't the case. Here they're doing standbys at events.
Yeah, yes. And so, the location is restricted, right? So that becomes, again, that's part of the problem in this case, and saying, well, you're really at the employer's mercy. You know, I think any time that employers try to come up with some scheme to not have to pay a person hourly, they run into risk. And we've talked about some of those before on our show, and the one that always pops into my brain and, Brad, I think you've talked about this practice in New York in the past, where we can't afford to have all these people running around. Because as you've said, if you work for the same employer and you have the same job, you can't be forced to work so many hours. And then, oh, when you're not working but you want to come back for that fire at night, you are going to be – you're going to volunteer. The federal government, for, you know, since the 1930s, has said we're not going to let employers – force their people to be volunteers, you know, when they are already being paid for a job. So the question is, you know, are they two separate employers? No, it's the same fire department, whatever. Is it the same job? Well, some of the employers, and again, I think about New York, where they say, well, your volunteer job is you're a firefighter, but during the day, you're a houseman or you're an engineer or you're a custodian. And that's different than being a firefighter. So we're going to have you be stand around and be a custodian. And initially, that sounds like a great thing. But, Brad, you want to say why in reality we know that doesn't work?
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, if this is a practice you're doing, we all have one piece of advice, stop. So what happens is exactly that, right? Oh, I'm a custodian, and I can my employer is so good I get to leave work as a volunteer. They're going to keep paying me, which is fine. But they're going to keep paying me, but I'm a volunteer going on ambulance call. However, when you start to peel back the layer of the onions, you find a few interesting factors. For one, you find that the only people who are allowed to be housemen happen to be the volunteers in the fire department. And the only people who are allowed to be housemen and caretakers happen to be EMTs so that they can get on the ambulance. Or they happen to be firefighters. Right. And so the dominoes now keep falling. So here's a question. What happens if the caretaker, the janitor says, I don't want to go on that call. I refuse to go on that call. Do they get fired? Do they get disciplined? What happens if they let their EMT or their firefighter certification lapse? Do they get fired? What happens if all of the janitors get together and say, we don't feel like doing this anymore? What happens when they get injured on the job and the department says, oh, no, you are a volunteer. You get your full volunteer benefits. And then workers' comp comes in because at least in New York, that's who's going to look at you. And workers' comp says, wait a minute. You are a janitor going on an EMT call. We don't know that you are a volunteer because you were getting paid by your employer. Maybe you're a paid person. And then the problem is you don't get all the good volunteer disability benefits. You get two-thirds of your crappy salary, right, which is not as good as the volunteer benefit. And I can keep going. What about when the call goes beyond your 40 hours? Well,
yeah,
you're a volunteer on the call, right? Are you getting time and a half or are you not? And if you're getting time and a half, you lose, right? If you have a volunteer who's at their 39th hour, the call comes in and they, you know, they're on a 3-hour, 4-hour EMS call because they're doing whatever, right? And you pay them time and a half, you just admitted that they are a paid employee because you paid them extra time out when they're volunteering. So this, and let me just add one more. My favorite, in New York State at least, to drive a fire truck, if you're a volunteer firefighter, you do not need to have a commercial driver's license, a CDL. But if you are a mechanic or a janitor and you want to drive the fire truck around for any purpose, you need a CDL. You don't meet the volunteer fire exception. So if your janitors are driving fire trucks, right, as part of their duties, everyone tells me, oh, they're doing it as a volunteer firefighter. They don't need a CDL. Well, then you've just admitted they're a volunteer firefighter, not a janitor. So there are so many problems. And this is, I'm going to end my diatribe again with what Chip said. This is all great until it's not. This is like every business partner thinking they're never going to be in a fight with their business partner. It's like thinking no marriage is ever going to end in divorce. When this goes bad, it goes south real quick.
Yep.
So, guys, is there any topic we haven't touched?
I think that's it. You know, I mean, it's just it's prevalent. I know Kurt talking about the subject. I do too, because and I think, in all fairness, you know, we talk about that this applies to, you know, the career firefighters. The career firefighters is a very different animal, and how some of the overtime issues come up there. And a lot of times it's cities trying to not have to pay for overtime, or, you know, whether or not the battalion chief and his duties is entitled to overtime, or whether it's a 40-hour, 53-hour job. And, you know, that those things get analyzed. When we're talking about the volunteer departments, it's usually departments that say, we don't have enough money to do it the right way, or that they even thought about it, and they're trying to, you know, okay, again, we'll pay you during the day, but not at night, or, you know, we're going to come up with this other way so we don't have to pay everybody overtime. And at the end of the day, you know, you already don't have a lot of money to begin with, and then, you know, this stuff hits, and we've already gone through just how bad it is. I think it's a serious problem in many areas of the country, and people don't realize it. I think it's an area that is just, it can blow up if people aren't paying attention.
And I got to tell you, if I wanted to end my career representing firefighters, I could make hundreds of millions of dollars suing the fire departments for this exact same thing. I would never do it, but I fear the attorney would. Okay, closing comments from John.
Yeah, I just want to say that, you know, the history of the voluntary fire service is strong, I think, across the country, and especially in my state, and working with volunteers since I've been in the fire service, it's an admirable group of people that try to do the best they can, you know, under sort of some arduous circumstances. I think that over time, we're seeing that there's an increasing need for firefighters in communities. And so I think fire departments essentially, you know, with a wink and a nod and maybe a handshake, is that, you know, you can live here, you can respond out of here, we'll help train you, we'll pay you, you know, a little bit of money. And when it becomes to a point where now you're looking at volunteers in a career status, although they're not declared career, I think part of this is the ignorance that may go on as it deals with the fire chiefs or with the fire commissioners in these districts that maybe not as sophisticated as other organizations around the state or around the country, but certainly there are enough high-end law firms in the state of Washington that understands volunteer issues and can consult with, you know, are we doing the right thing. I think this case is going to bring that whole issue to a point where fire chiefs and fire commissioners, especially in fire districts who do have limited financial resources, will have to take a strong look at this particular case and what are we doing currently that, you know, we're doing wrong, and then how are we going to fix it? And, you know, is the fix going to be sufficient enough to prevent litigation against our organization? I think one of the interesting things we talked about a little bit earlier is the failure or the declination to file a waiver or sign a waiver by the volunteers or whether the waiver was pushed by the department to say, you've agreed to work in a volunteer capacity, you're not full-time employees. However, you know, if you understand what the IRS definition of employee is, it's pretty clear cut that they were, not volunteers. They were essentially de facto career employees. And I think the department on this particular case screwed the pooch. It did a disservice to the community because fire districts here, like in many places, have limited resources. They don't generate money. They basically work off of maybe transport fees and property tax. So there's a limited amount of money. And if you're paying, $2 or $3 million in a judgment based on, ignorance, then, why are you still working in that particular fire district? I am done.
Fantastic. Well, I can't think of any better advice than given by the three of us, because, that's who gives the best advice. So if you have not learned anything from today, then you have not listened. On behalf of Chip, John, myself, and somewhere missing in action, but we say hello, Kurt, I wish you all the very best as we come up to the holiday season. We will join you after the holiday season. From the members of Fire Service Court Radio, we look forward to seeing you on our next show.